I'm Crystal Faulkner.
And I'm Tom Cooney.
And this is BusinessWise. Our guest today is Milton Dahoney. He is the city manager for the city of Cincinnati. And I know that the streetcar has been certainly a subject of extensive conversation and controversy, and that I believe you perceive to be really an asset for our city.
Well, where it stands right now, we are getting closer to setting a groundbreaking date, and that would allow for the beginning of construction of the line. I continue to believe that it is something that's going to have long-term benefits for the city. And when you look around the country, there are 60, 70 other cities that have the same viewpoint. So my thinking has always been we're either going to be competitive or we're going to get left behind.
Assuming that you set this groundbreaking date pretty soon, how long approximately will the construction period start? When will we actually see a streetcar, you know, starting to move?
We would not see a streetcar actually operating in the city for about 2 years, because there's a pretty long construction process, but you would see signs of it coming together a lot sooner than that, because within about a month, we'll actually choose the car that we would commission to be made, and so people would see it. And then when it arrived, people would see that. When we do the maintenance facility, people would see that. So there will be signs. We've already tagged the stops and put signs on that.
It still seems, though, that there's groups of people who are trying to stop this. And is it going forward for sure?
It is going forward. There have been two unsuccessful ballot attempts to stop it. And so I don't really see another ballot initiative, but there are some people who still are not supportive.
And I know that there's been some discussions about the county owning the utilities and therefore the city can't move forward. What's that about?
The utility issue is focused simply on the utilities that are underground or under the streetcar line, so to speak. Do those utilities have to be moved? And if they have to be moved, how far and who pays?
In Denver was pretty phenomenal. That their case, though, was a light rail system. Do you see the light rail system in a city like Denver being equivalent to the same kind of economic growth as what you anticipate around the streetcar?
It's not exactly the same, but the fact that it's fixed rail will stimulate development. And when you go to cities that have already done it, it's just all you have to do is look around. Entrepreneurs see that fixed rail and know I have an audience passing me every single day, and I want to have my business as close to that as possible.
For BusinessWise, I'm Crystal Faulkner.
And I'm Tom Cooney. We're with Cooney, Faulkner & Stevens, your business advocate. I'm Tom Cooney.
And I'm Crystal Faulkner.
And this is BusinessWise. Today, our guest is Milton Dahoney, who's the city manager of the city of Cincinnati. And Milton, we've talked about the streetcar really a number of times. And as I understand it, initially, the first phase of it is going to be a couple miles around downtown Cincinnati. What's it going to be like long term?
Well, long term, I think the connectivity will extend into northern Kentucky. I think long term, there would be a line that goes to the airport. I don't necessarily see the line going to the airport as streetcar. I see that as light rail because you need it to move a lot faster. But if you think about cities that you've traveled to, a lot of them you can get off of the airplane and get on light rail and go into downtown.
Why wouldn't it have gone just right across the river into Covington or Newport?
Well, you have to have what's called a starter line. And so the starter line could have simply connected the banks to northern Kentucky. The initial line was meant to connect some of the assets in Cincinnati. And so while some may be concerned about the shortness of the line, you have to keep in mind it's a starter line. So cities that do this, they don't come out of the gate and say, we're going to build 60 miles of track. They all say we're going to build it in segments. When we build the new Brent Spence Bridge, we're going to build that bridge in segments. That's the only way that you can get it done. So you'll build a segment and you'll build on that and move across the river.
There's been much discussion about whether or not the streetcar is going to be sustainable in terms of paying for itself. Where's the money going to come from to operate it on a daily basis after it's built?
The money to build it is coming from a variety of sources, and the money to operate it is coming from a variety of sources. There is no rail line anywhere where the fare box pays for it. So we've never tried to indicate that. But that's a revenue stream that you get from the fare box. The people that want naming rights is another revenue stream. What we are proposing to do is to take a portion of the revenue that we will get from the operation of the casino, which is new money. It's not currently here, not currently being used for any other purpose, and ensure the sustainable operation of the streetcar. As the streetcar line grows, we would continue to look to federal sources to provide funding for that. The revenue that that would occur as a result of the development that's being spurred because the line is there expands the city's tax base. That's where you get your money to do city services throughout the city.
So you don't think we'll have to impose additional taxes?
I don't really see the tax route as the preferred method in Cincinnati. Although if you look at other cities, that's exactly what they've done. If you go to Charlotte, they passed a tax to pay for it even before the line was built because they see the value in it long term and were willing to do that.
Well, Milton, we're out of time. Okay. I will have to have you come back as more progress continues on the streetcar.
It does
sound like an exciting thing. So for Business Wise, I'm Crystal Faulkner.
And I'm Tom Cooney. We're with Cooney, Faulkner & Stevens, your business advocate.
I'm Crystal Faulkner.
And I'm Tom Cooney.
And this is Business Wise. Tom, a question that we received recently that we actually wrote about in the Enquirer in our weekly column on Thursdays was a business owner who had suffered through the economy. Frankly, he had low profitability, poor cash flow, but the good news is now that the economy's rebounding, he's back to profits, his cash flow's improving. During the time that he was having a little bit of a rocky road, he charged a lot of his business expenses on his credit cards. And his question is, should he pay those credit card bills off first, or should he resume contributing to his 401k plan?
Well, and the answer is, assuming that the credit card interest rate is a fairly high rate, which most of them are, you want to pay that down as quickly as possible. Now, maybe there's another alternative to choosing between the retirement plan and paying off the credit card. Maybe you can get lower interest loans, perhaps, you know, a conventional line of credit now that he's profitable and has cash flow. It's not easy to get loans, but if you're profitable and have cash flow and are willing to guarantee the loans, generally banks are willing to lend to you.
You mentioned that it would be better off for him to pay his credit card debt down before resuming contributions to his retirement plan. Because if you think about, let's just assume that his credit card interest rate was 18% and he pays the credit card off. I mean, that's like an 18% return. You're not going to get that in investments these days. If you can go out now and engage a banker, talk them about the opportunity to increase your credit line, get a new credit line, this would be a good time.
Well, and I think funding your retirement is very important, but you can make that up in a later year if you need the cash now to pay down your credit.
And you mentioned making it up in a later year, and certainly we don't want to discount the benefits of putting the money in as soon as you can, because obviously that magic of compounding, you can never get those years back. But as a business owner, you do have some ability to be a little more flexible in how much you put in. And clearly, if the 401k plan's not working for you, depending on your age, the age of your employees, and you're not putting enough in, you can also look at other plans that might give you bigger benefits somewhere down the road when you do start contributing to your retirement plan again.
There's lots of opportunities to put large amounts of money into a retirement plan if you have the cash to do so.
Now, just to be clear, our advice would be different if this individual were not the business owner, if this were an employee of the business who had incurred a lot of credit card debt through the downturn. For example, if he'd been laid off, his hours had been reduced, now he's working for this company. Our advice would be a bit different in terms of how to structure and balance how much he's putting into the retirement plan versus paying down credit card debt.
Because if you're participating in a 401k plan, in most instances, there's some type of match. And that match can be 25 to 50, sometimes even 100% of your contribution up to a certain amount. That's like getting a 25, 50, or 100% return on your investment. So normally, you're going to be much better off in the long run putting money into your 401k and extending that credit card debt, even though it's high interest, but at a lower interest rate than your return on your investment.
And certainly in the meantime, while you're funding your retirement plan to the full extent of the match, look for those opportunities for zero balance transfer, if it makes sense. Even if the 0% is only for a few months, it still could make a big difference. For Business Wise, I'm Crystal Faulkner.
And I'm Tom Cooney. We're with Cooney, Faulkner & Stevens, your trusted business advocate. I'm Tom Cooney.
And I'm Crystal Faulkner.
And this is BusinessWise. And Crystal, today our topic is what's new in taxes for 2012, or maybe more specifically, what should you be doing in 2012 to take advantage of the tax rules that are out there that may not be there next year?
And that's a big question, Tom, because, you know, I'm a real believer in we've got to take action on what we know that we can deal with. I mean, there's clearly a lot of uncertainty. What do we know? What can we control? And does it make sense for us to act on those issues this year and take advantage of those benefits?
Well, one thing we know about estate taxes is there's approximately a $5 million exemption from estate or gift taxes that each person has. So a couple that has a business can gift up to $10 million of value of their stock this year and not pay any gift tax on that and get it out of their estate.
That is a huge benefit. And with some of the economic conditions that many businesses have been experiencing, there's probably a case to be made in many cases where you can take the position the business is really at a low value right now. So you can transfer a lot of value. Real estate is also a great opportunity if people have real estate holdings and they have those in LLCs, for example, to actually gift units of the LLC interest. Often you can take discounts for lack of marketability and minority interest, which even allows you to gift more.
And that $10 million exemption translates to a tax savings, an estate tax savings of about $4 million. So it's pretty significant. And the reason it may make sense to do that this year is the current estate law expires in 2012. And we know, or at least we think, there will be a new one.
And what we also know is that the what we always call the Bush tax cuts, they're going to expire at the end of 2012, too. And the president said he is not going to renew those. So whether he wins or loses, those provisions will most likely expire. You have to take advantage of things, again, that you know that you can do and you can control.
And what we know is that if those cuts expire, tax rates are going up for higher income people. Even if they don't expire, tax rates are going up because of the health care reform added.
Yes.
Medicare tax.
At 3.6 kits in next year. But, you know, you mentioned something, Tom, that I think is very misleading. You mentioned for high-income people. Absolutely, the rates are going to go up for high-income people. But if the Bush tax cuts expire, there's going to be a lot of middle-income people that are also going to be paying a lot of tax that they aren't now because there's many provisions in there that benefit middle-income people. So don't assume that if you're not the part of the 1% that you won't be affected. You do need to be taking action to make sure that things that are in place this year that may not be next year, that you can take advantage of everything that you can get, frankly.
That's very true. For instance, alternative minimum tax will go up for most everyone because that exemption will go down if nothing is changed legislatively.
There's several credits in there that will go away as well if the Bush tax cuts aren't expanded, which many middle-income people take advantage of.
Well, and one thing that has changed in 2012, in 2011, we had the 100% bonus depreciation that most businesses could take for additions to machinery and equipment and furniture and fixtures. That's been reduced to 50% for 2012, although there's still a very large Section 179 deduction that will allow most businesses to expense their asset additions.
And we know that capital gains rates are still pretty low this year. They're still at 15%. They may, and very well, most likely will go up if the Bush tax cuts aren't reinstated. So again, the whole point of this conversation is just to be alert, keep your ear to the ground, and take action if it makes sense for you. For BusinessWise, I'm Crystal Faulkner.
And I'm Tom Cooney. We're with Cooney, Faulkner & Stevens, your trusted business advocate.
I'm Crystal Faulkner.
And I'm Tom Cooney.
And this is BusinessWise. Our guests today are Donna and Doug Browning, and Donna is the founder of Sweaty Bands. And Donna, I have seen your Sweaty Bands so many places, and I've heard so much about you. I'm just so thrilled that the two of you are a guest.
Thank
and
you.
I'm sitting here looking at you, and you have this amazing band around your head. It's silver and kind of glittery, and but yet you're in jeans. So you can wear these Sweaty Bands with anything.
You can, and that's one of the things that women have, you know, said that they love so much about Sweaty Bands, because they wear them to the gym, but then they can also wear them out on a Saturday night or just to run errands.
And Doug, you don't have a sweaty band on. But
I do not wear them. I always we wouldn't sell many if I wore them.
But you both are very active in terms of exercise and well-being and health.
Mm-hmm.
Is that how you started this company, or where did the idea of Sweaty Bands come from?
I have been teaching fitness classes since 1989, and I just always needed something to keep my hair back when I taught, because any woman who has long or short hair when they're exercising, they need to pull their hair back. For years, I would just wear the little cotton ones, and they would shoot off the back of my head, and bandanas. You remember the bandana craze also? And just always needed something that was going to absorb sweat that would look cute. And I just started making these, what I now call sweaty bands, on a friend's sewing machine for myself. And my daughters wanted them, and their friends wanted them, and we gave them away as gifts. And then my students in my class wanted them. So I started carrying around a Ziploc bag full of them and started selling them to my students, then built a website with no website experience, and just sort of kept putting one foot in front of the other and proceeding.
What's different about Sweaty Bands from other bands that's made it morph into such a good business?
Well,
for
I
you?
Think the best quality, or one of the two best qualities, is that they don't slip. We've always needed something that doesn't fall out when you're running. I see pre-wrap or whatever on the soccer field and on the running trail on the sidewalk, but they don't slip and they look really darn cute.
Well, they are cute. And, you know, the cute word is an important thing when you're talking to young girls, especially
yes.
even older girls like me. So clearly there's a need. And
right.
I can see how the sweaty band would be just a wonderful alternative.
Yeah, it keeps all those little flyaways down and out of your face.
The key, it seems to me, in most any successful business is when you've actually identified a need.
Right.
And then you come along and solve
yes.
that problem. And
right.
that's what you've done here. You've
yeah.
actually created a business by solving a problem.
Yeah, that's exactly what it is. It was creating a need where nobody realized there was a need before. So we, you know, have a brand new product category that we've created.
And you're no longer just carrying these around in Ziploc bags, are
oh,
you?
Oh, no, not at all. We're in over 1,000 stores all across the United States and really all across the world.
If people want to learn more, or if they want to go online to see what a sweaty band looks like, how can they find that information?
Go to sweatybands.com, and you can see all of our styles.
Thanks
for business-wise, I'm Crystal Faulkner.
And I'm Tom Cooney. We're with Cooney, Faulkner & Stevens, your business advocate. I'm Tom Cooney.
And I'm Crystal Faulkner.
And this is BusinessWise. Today, our guests are Donna and Doug Browning. They are the founders and owners of Sweaty Bands. And I know that you all started Sweaty Bands and really started as a business in 2008, you know, right at the beginning of the worst recession of our lifetimes. How difficult was it to start a business at that point in time?
I guess it was difficult and it wasn't difficult. The one thing, it was good time for me to jump in, and I saw what was going on with how Donna created this business, and I saw an opportunity to try to grow it. The down period in the economy, and for us to be able to sell product at that time, I think is just been a blessing. I mean, we've worked extremely hard, and we don't take anything for granted. You know, I've come from a sales background, and I've never been in a business where people have contacted us to buy things. It's always salespersons hustling to make a sale. So that's what we consider a blessing, but it's just been a good run for us.
For you, as Tom mentioned, to start this business in the worst recession we've seen, and the success you've achieved, absolutely a blessing, but I also think it speaks probably to your persistence, your passion, your desire. Those are the key things mm-hmm. that smart business people use, but they also seek outside help and guidance and so forth. Do you guys have a board of advisors or mentors? Or
well, we do not have a board of advisors. We've spent a lot of time reading. We really haven't had much advice from other business owners. I think just from our experience with what we've both done after our college life, we've had a lot of business experience. I think that all is lended to us being able to do it today. You know, a lot of the stuff that I read has been very helpful for me, and I try to share it some with Donna. She laughs at some of this stuff. You know, one of the big things is I don't think we're afraid to take risks, and mm-hmm. that's what we read a lot about. My parents sometimes think we're crazy. We're willing to take that risk, and I think that's what's helped us get through it.
I think that's a common thread. If you look at highly successful entrepreneurs, they make calculated risks.
As a male, I don't wear sweaty bands, but when you talk about faith in the product, I've sold enough of them to believe that it truly is a product that women love and really enjoy it and helps their life. I mean, it's crazy to believe
that. And
they're
cute, right, Donna? They're very cute.
Totally cute, yeah.
I know our 16-year-old would love to have those. That's what I'm going to do is go find some right after this. Real quick before we leave, so you guys are married.
Mm-hmm.
How is that working together?
Donna, I'll let you
Well, it's been a blast because the whole business has been such a blast. We've traveled all across the United States and seen cities, you know, that we wouldn't have been to and been successful. So, I mean, there's nothing to complain about.
Well, if folks want to learn more about your business, about Sweaty Bands, how to get one of these cute Sweaty Bands, where can they find the Sweaty Bands or learn
Sweatybands.com. More? Sweatybands.com. You can find any phone numbers, emails. You can contact us. It's all on the website.
For Business Wise, I'm Crystal Faulkner.
And I'm Tom Cooney. We're with Cooney, Faulkner & Stevens, your business advocate.
I'm Crystal Faulkner, and this is Business Wise. My guest today is Steve Stevens. Steve is the president of the Northern Kentucky Chamber of Commerce. There is so much excitement that's going on the Northern Kentucky side of the river. Last week or two, we've just heard of the new UpTech initiative that is coming on here. Actually, partnership with Northern Kentucky University College of Informatics, as well as the E-Zone and many other organizations. What else? Let's talk about some other exciting things happening on this side of the river.
I think, you know, things are really looking brighter all the time here. I think our unemployment rate's dropping. That's always a bright spot. People are getting reemployed that maybe have been sitting on the sidelines. We're seeing a lot of growth in areas like manufacturing and some of those areas, so that I think things are going to continue to improve over this next year, which is really encouraging. But we have some assets now that we didn't have, like the College of Informatics at NKU, and that helps us sell our region. You know, whether it's on this side of the river or the other side of the region, we were looking for things that we can market to businesses, prospective newcomers to this community, but also how do you help people expand? So I think we're positioned pretty well right now.
And provide jobs, right?
That's one of the most frustrating elements of this whole situation currently, is the fact that we do know we're over 8% unemployment, and we have got, you know, just from our own view, we can see on our jobs website that the chamber manages that we see postings daily. We see some of them sit there a long time, and the reason they're there for a long time is because the skill sets are not present in the people that we have currently.
But what I really think is wonderful is that I do think our educational institutions, including Northern Kentucky University and certainly Gateway Community College, these organizations have taken it upon themselves to interact with the business community, find out what skills are needed, and then we're training people, we're educating people to fill that skill set.
Absolutely. I think the folks at both institutions you named, you know, are boots on the ground that are getting into businesses more often, and they're talking to them. I know when I go out and visit with companies periodically and they tell me of a workforce problem or issue, I can pick up the phone and call them, and they will return that call right away to that business and sit down and really try to figure out a strategy. If they are not offering programs currently, can they do something to tailor what they have to really deliver the training for the skill sets that are required? You know, we're a conduit of all sorts. We've got to have our antenna up a whole lot about, you know, business needs, business problem solving, things like that. And then when we hear of those things, we have to be kind of in the know about everything in some ways about this community, so that we can channel the resources to the businesses that really are looking for help in some ways, or an incentive program that they may not know about that they can capitalize on to help them expand, just a wide range of things. And some of the stuff can come right from this chamber, because we have a very capable, talented workforce division. We have folks that are involved in international trade to help people get into the business of doing trade in foreign countries, because our markets are not that hot right now, you know. And, you know, we have some expertise that we offer to businesses, and hopefully they can discover us if they're not already members of us to try to help them.
So if people out there listening would like to know more about the Northern Kentucky Chamber of Commerce, how can they reach you?
First, look at our website, www.nkychamber.com, or just call us at 859-578-8800.
For Business Wise, I'm Crystal Faulkner. I'm with Cooney, Faulkner & Stevens, your business advocate. I'm Crystal Faulkner, and this is Business Wise. My guest today is Steve Stevens. Steve is the president of the Northern Kentucky Chamber of Commerce, and you've been very active in our community, in our region, and really in the state. And the chamber does a lot of things that I think most people don't realize, including government advocacy. What's going on right now in terms of what your role is in helping move legislation along in the state of Kentucky?
We're in the middle of a legislative session right now. It started in January and finishes in April, and this is a budget session, so it's a little more challenging because that's a big thing that is absolutely a mandatory item that has to be done during the session. And then, of course, redistricting comes around once every 10 years, and that's a real challenge, very volatile, very, high tension. So it really kind of squeezes the time that is allowed for other productive pieces of legislation. We are involved in a lot of things, but one of the main things that we're working on this year is a jobs package. And the jobs package is something that we sort of had some ideas about that we really felt like could really move us forward, not only this region, but the entire Commonwealth. And it's really a three-legged stool. And the idea behind it is, first of all, we want to make sure we retain the jobs that we have currently and the companies in this region. So we look at ourselves and say, how can we be competitive so we're as attractive as any other region, any other state, so people aren't lured away or something looks more attractive? The second is, we know that there are companies right here today, these existing companies, that have the capacity and probably even the desire to expand. But what keeps them from doing that? They're uncertain. Sometimes they need capital. They need some changes to laws and so forth. So we've looked at a set of things that might improve that situation. And the final thing is, how do we create new jobs? How do we attract companies here? But really, how do we start some new businesses? UpTech is one of those ways, but there are things that really can help promote entrepreneurship and small business startups.
When you say we're looking at that. Who is we?
The Northern Kentucky Chamber first put this program together and put it out, and we have a few partners that we always like to talk with first who totally embraced it. And those are some other chambers that are in the metropolitan areas. The State Chamber of Commerce in Kentucky has really bought into this idea, and they have helped promote it. And now we are absolutely creating this as a statewide initiative, not just Northern Kentucky, but we started the whole ball rolling, and it is really picking up momentum.
You know, there's been a lot of discussion recently about this whole concept of one side of the river, Cincinnati or Northern Kentucky, poaching companies from the other side and from state to state. What do you think about that?
Well, I know because I'm personally involved with our economic development entity in Northern Kentucky, and it has been the same for the Cincinnati side. There is a truce of sorts. I mean, we don't go after each other's businesses
within here in the region,
in the local.
Mean?
What we can't control as much is what the states do to try to help, you know, bring one company from one state to the other, which is what happened recently. You know, I think we will always try to make sure the playing field is level, but there will always be things that don't make us competitive with one another. We have to just accept the fact that from time to time, somebody's going to slip away from us. I know several have come from Cincinnati over the last decade or so and located in Northern Kentucky. Now it's going the opposite way right now, and we'll probably have a pendulum swing forever.
The whole idea of gaming, I know you and I have talked about this many times, but Kentucky still doesn't have gaming legislation. Where does that stand?
Well, it is moving now, finally. It appears that a bill is about to be dropped, and by the time this program airs, it will, I think, and it will be an opportunity for the citizens of Kentucky to vote to make this the law of the land. That's some progress.
If folks would like to get more information about the chamber, what's your contact information?
You can always check our website at www.nkychamber.com. You can also go to NKY Chamber on our social media, Facebook and Twitter, as well as 859-578-8800.
For BusinessWise, I'm Crystal Faulkner. I'm with Cooney Faulkner & Stevens, your business advocate. I'm Crystal Faulkner, and this is BusinessWise. My guest today is Kevin Hughes. Kevin is the current Executive Managing Director for Jones Lang LaSalle. Kevin, you have spent your entire career in commercial and corporate real estate services. You've been very successful here locally, building your own company through mergers and acquisitions that grew into a national organization. Then you spent 5 years leading and building a global corporate services platform. In 2009, you've had something happened. There was a change of heart, and you literally dropped all of that to lead a very small not-for-profit. So let's talk about that.
Sure. I don't think that there's a single thing that happened. I didn't have a midlife crisis or anything like that.
I was going to ask you about that, but you notice I refrained.
No, nothing like that. You know, I've been incredibly blessed. I have a career where I worked with wonderful people, had wonderful clients. Home life is great, supportive wife, healthy kids, all that good stuff. I started serving on the board at Cornerstone Corporation for Shared Equity in 2002. So by 2009, it had been 7 years since we introduced this new idea called renter equity, which I'll explain later. I've always believed we all have this little voice in your head that tells you you could do more. And this renter equity concept, which is all built on the reality that if you don't have assets, you'll never get ahead in life, was proving to be more than just a concept. It was really had 7 years of a track record, but was kind of hiding under a rock up on Green Street and over the Rhine. Like so many great little nonprofits, we were not going anywhere with it. You know, you ask yourself, what more can you do to help others if someone like me has been so blessed in so many ways. And after a while, you start saying, why can't you do it? Maybe we all want to do something as radical as I did. And again, being very fortunate to be able to kind of get off the train for a while and to be able to go to work every day for a couple of years, helping other people, helping grow something that you believe in, and doing it without a paycheck, it's not easy to do. And I could do all that, and it became why not instead of
why. Well, you're right. I mean, I think a lot of people probably have that passion to do something. They don't know how to do it. They're afraid. But you mentioned Green Street. That's where your office was. That's where you went to work for every day for a couple of years.
Yeah.
But before we talk specifically about the work of Cornerstone, let's talk about the Over the Rhine area and just poverty in general. Do you feel now, having lived that world for 2 years, that the whole idea of people who are in poverty and the perceptions of those folks, what do you say to that?
There's so many great things that have happened over the Rhine over the past decade. I think it's important to distinguish between north over the Rhine, where Green Street is, where our projects are, and what today is a very vibrant, growing community, a lot of young professionals, a huge gentrification going on between Central Parkway and Liberty. All great stuff, all driven by the wonderful work of Steve Leeper and 3CDC. Good stuff there. Kind of the great wall between poverty and the CBD has been kind of moved from Central Parkway up to Liberty. You know, I think that the average citizen in our region, when they think of Over the Rhine, they clearly think of crime and violence and drugs and vacant buildings and homelessness, and it's all there for you. It's right in your face every day. And with the $200 million of investment that we've made in Over the Rhine south of Liberty is at risk when just north of Liberty, there's gunfire really every couple of weeks.
For Business Wise, I'm Crystal Faulkner. I'm with Cooney Faulkner and Stevens, your business advocate. I'm Crystal Faulkner, and this is Business Wise. My guest today is Kevin Hughes. Kevin is the executive managing director of Jones Lang LaSalle, which is a real estate organization, a national real estate organization. And for a couple of years, you actually left the day-to-day routine of wonderful career, a great job, and you followed your heart and you went to work down on Green Street and over the Rhine, and you led an organization called Cornerstone, where you worked with a lot of folks who unfortunately are just very disadvantaged, and some people would call them people in poverty. There is a lot of misconception about the term poverty.
Right.
Many people think people who are, quote, in poverty are lazy. Mm-hmm. They don't have the gumption to go about finding a job. What did you learn while you spent those 2 years down at Cornerstone?
Well, first of all, the average income of our residents is a little bit less than $20,000 a family. So they're below the line. So they are living in poverty. And you're right, there's a lot of misconceptions about poverty. And there are poor people that are lazy, and there are wealthy people that are lazy. So crosses all lines. Our program at Cornerstone is really looking to help people, give them a hand up rather than a handout. I think before I decided to get out of capitalism for a while and do this nonprofit thing, I tried to do my homework to understand those issues because they're deep. And you have to ask yourself, how did we get to this point? You know, this issue of having this cycle of dependency, if you will. I tried to do my homework. I certainly learned a lot more going to work there every day, understanding the people that are actually living in those difficult conditions. And I would explain it this way. With all the good intentions in the world, a lot of bright people, typically bureaucrats, politicians, academics, with no real experience of living in poverty, are to blame, all right, with good intentions, mm-hmm. of creating this cycle of dependency. It starts with this mentality that we're going to study what these issues are in the urban low-income communities. And then we're going to come in here and we're going to teach you, the residents, the nature and the extent of your problems, and then we're going to fix it for you. That's what happens. So here's all the services we're going to provide, and it creates this deficiency model. Rather than focusing on the community and the assets in the community, i.e. the strengths and the capacity of the people that mm-hmm. live there, and taking those people and mobilizing them to resolve the problems and come up with the solutions of their own neighborhoods. Instead, we focus on the deficiencies and the problems of those neighborhoods and say, here's how we're going to fix it. So we're going to provide you these wonderful services and programs, which we've been doing for generations now. And after a while, the residents see themselves as people with special needs. You get generations of this. And the solutions are provided by outsiders. So we've created these client neighborhoods where the most important relationships in any neighborhood resist among the local residents. That's the glue of a community. It's what binds people together, their mutual support, their problem solving together. Now, the most important relationships for a resident in the urban low-income neighborhoods is the relationship they have with their social worker, their health provider, sure, their funder. And the glue that binds has been weakened.
But at Cornerstone, you've taught them how to help themselves.
Our platform for our renter equity program is low-income housing. And in our community, where we have a 3 to 4 year waiting list for people wanting to get into our apartment community on arguably the most violent neighborhood in our community, says that everybody has a job to do in the community. So they're small jobs, but mm-hmm. they create accountability, a sense of ownership. Everyone has to pay their rent on time, and you must attend a mandatory monthly renter association meeting. So the binds of community are reestablished. They run their community. Our apartment community is beautiful. It really
is. I've seen pictures. I know it is.
It's wonderful.
But if people would like more information about Cornerstone.
The organization is Cornerstone Corporation for Shared Equity. So we have a website. Anyone could call me anytime on LinkedIn or Google me or whatever, or call me on my cell phone, 513-236-5000.
For BusinessWise, I'm Crystal Faulkner. I'm with Cooney, Faulkner & Stevens, your business advocate.